Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Barbara Slavin, who has been the senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today since 1996, and she has been recently doing some of the best coverage on Iran. And we'll be talking to her about how the United States and Iran appear to be playing a geopolitical game of chicken. We'll also speak with General William Odom, who is a senior fellow and director of National Security Studies at the Hudson Institute. And he's also an adjunct professor at Yale University, and he is former the head of the National Security Agency and chief of Army Intelligence. And he has described the invasion and occupation of Iraq as the worst strategic mistake in American history. And in a new article, he compares Iraq to Vietnam. And then we'll speak with Todd Gitlin, who is a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University and the author of The Intellectuals and the Flag. And we'll be talking to him about the sale of Knight Ridder and the extent to which Wall Street is now determining what Americans learn about in the news. I'm speaking with Barbara Slavin. And Barbara Slavin has been the senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today since 1996, responsible for analyzing foreign news and U.S. foreign policy. She has covered such key issues as the U.S.-led war on terrorism and in Iraq, policy towards rogue states, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. She has accompanied three secretaries of state on their official travels, also reported from Iran, Libya, Israel, Egypt, North Korea, Russia, China, Saudi Arabia, and Syria, and, of course, has been a regular commentator on U.S. foreign policy on National Public Radio, PBS, and on C-SPAN. Prior to joining USA Today, she was a Washington-based writer for The Economist and the Los Angeles Times, covering domestic and foreign policy issues, including the 1991-93 Middle East peace talks in Washington. And from 1985 to 1989, she was The Economist correspondent in Cairo, where she traveled widely in the Middle East, covering the Iran-Iraq War, the 1986 U.S. bombing of Libya, the political evolution of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and the resurgence of Islamic fundamentalism. Early in the 1980s, she served as The Economist correspondent in Beijing and also reported from Japan and South Korea. Prior to moving abroad, she was a writer and editor for the New York Times Week in Review section and a reporter and editor of the United Press International in New York City. She got a BA in Russian language and literature at Harvard University and has also studied at Leningrad State University. She is also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And Barbara Slavin, I get the impression that the United States and Iran are playing a geopolitical game of chicken. Do you think, give us a sense of how much posturing there is and how much this thing could actually get out of control?
It's a very good question. There's a lot of posturing going on both sides. I mean, it's really fascinating to watch, especially since last week when the Iranians agreed to U.S. terms for a dialogue, an enormously important moment. You know, the United States has been offering since last fall to have talks just on Iraq with Zalmay Khalilzad, our ambassador there. And the Iranians have, at first they didn't respond, and then when I was there in early February, the National Security Advisor, Ali Larijani, said, well, yeah, they would talk to the United States, but they wanted to have a broad dialogue on the full range of issues. And now he's accepted the U.S. terms. Is this the beginning of something really momentous? Is it just a diversionary tactic on the part of the Iranians to take the heat off them at the United Nations, where they're considering a statement condemning Iran? You know, the Iranians are very experienced and practiced diplomats, and I think they're maneuvering frantically to try to be able to have their cake and eat it too, to have the nuclear program and still somehow not suffer the consequences. But there's also something else going on. There's another dynamic which is quite fascinating. You know, the two countries have been estranged for so long now. It's been 27 years. And there is an enormous desire among the Iranian people and also, I think, increasingly among Iranian officials to try to reestablish some kind of relationship with the United States. So this could be the beginning of that as well. Now, will the Bush administration play? Tough question. Clearly, the Iranians have some cards in Iraq that they have to play. But the Bush administration, of course, is very hostile to the Iranian government and has talked about basically overthrowing that regime. So stay tuned.
Well, I get the impression, though, that there's some disarray in some of these Iranian delegations that you mentioned on the diplomatic front, that progress is being made, but it's difficult to understand exactly whether the diplomats are really in charge of their agenda, whether they're somebody's breathing over their shoulder like the supreme leader or the president, Ahmadinejad, who is apparently was connected to the Beirut hijacking, is behind the killing of some Kurdish dissidents, and
I'll stop you there. A lot of that is not confirmed. What role he did or didn't play. He was not a leader of the hostage crisis with the United States. The people actually did lead that have denied it, and he has denied it.
But what about the Beirut TWA hijacking?
I'm not familiar with a role that he allegedly played at that time. He was in the Iran-Iraq War. He was a member of the Revolutionary Guards, and he served on the front in the Iraqi city of Kirkuk, as far as I know. I'm not aware that he had a role in that particular hijacking, although, of course, it is possible.
Well, my source on that is Bob Baird, who is pretty familiar with the CIA guy. He's pretty familiar with Hezbollah. So,
it's clear that he has a lot of unsavory contacts with a lot of unsavory elements in the Iranian regime. I was not aware of that particular allegation. I would say, though, that the Iranian system is a very complicated one. Ahmadinejad has a say, but he is not by any means the most influential figure on foreign policy. In fact, he usually isn't in the room when they're working out their strategy on the nuclear question. Much more important is Ali Ladijani, the national security advisor. Of course, the Ali Khamenei, who is the supreme religious leader of the country. And there are others, like former President Rafsanjani, who are also extremely influential. Members of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, also very influential. So it's a system which is, making foreign policy by consensus. I would say that it's more unified now than it has been for some time because, as you recall, there was a reformer as president, Mohammad Khatami, from 1997 until 2005. And he often would make gestures toward the United States, but would be blocked by more conservative members of the administration. Now, conservatives basically control the whole system, from the supreme leader to the presidency to the parliament and so on. So this decision to agree to these talks with the United States, I'm sure, was a consensus decision.
And do you think that, I've been reading reports quoting Iranian diplomats and academics like Professor Nasrhadiyan and others suggesting that there's a lot of disquiet amongst perhaps the intellectuals in Tehran that this government has been blundering, in fact, the Iranian government, the extent to which one of them was quoted as saying, it's taken the United States 27 years to try and get us to the national UN Security Council, and now we've handed it to them on a plate.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of criticism. It's in the press. People spoke quite openly about it when I was there, and it's not just from the political opposition, but within the conservative camp. The Iranians had a negotiation going on with the Europeans for over 2 years, and they were not dragged to the Security Council. This government came in and decided to break off those talks, to reject a European offer, and 7 months later, they are on the verge of condemnation in the Security Council. I was in Iran on February the 4th when the International Atomic Energy Agency voted to send Iran to the Security Council, and it really created a jolt in the country, a lot of hostile questioning of government officials by Iranians. So I think it's fair to say that they are now looking to perhaps change tactics a bit to try to recover some of the ground that they've lost. And we'll see what happens at the UN, whether this is going to affect the debate there. The Bush administration very much wants to get something on paper, on the record at the UN condemning Iran to set down that marker. And it will be very interesting to see whether they succeed this week or whether this Iranian agreement to talk is somehow going to have an impact. The Bush administration says they're not going to talk about the nuclear issue with the Iranians, but we will see.
Well, apparently, the Bush administration is saying that our talks with Iran are restricted to what's happening in Iraq. And as you mentioned earlier, Barbara Slavin, that Iran has influence in Iraq. Recently, the Secretary of Defense complained that the Iranians were meddling. The Al-Quds, I guess the Jerusalem Brigade is in there, is apparently in there causing mischief. Many analysts, and we'll be speaking in a moment to General William Odom, who's a fairly prescient critic of the Iraq War. There's a sense that geopolitically we have blundered and have handed Iraq, or at least the oil-rich part of Iraq, to Iran.
It's such an interesting time. You know, absolutely. I mean, the United States complaining about Iranian influence in Iraq is like shooting your parents and then complaining that you're an orphan. I mean, the U.S. handed this part of Iraq to Iran, in effect, when it got rid of Saddam Hussein. Most of the Shiite militias, a lot of the Shiite leaders in Iraq, were given refuge by Iran when Saddam Hussein was in power. And so they have very strong links with Iran, and it's extremely natural that Iran would want to exercise influence. There was also a vacuum that was created when the U.S. came in and knocked out the Baathists, and an enormous opportunity for Iranians to come in with their own reconstruction help, their own foreign aid. So they've built links to many elements of the society in Iran, not in Iraq, not just the Shiites, but other groups as well. And now we're complaining that they're trying to call in these options. But at the same time, Iran has vulnerabilities too. The economy, believe it or not, is not in good shape, despite record oil prices. Inflation is high. The currency is losing value. Iran has to import 40% of its gasoline. Since this new president, Ahmadinejad, came in, there's been an enormous hard currency outflow. Billions of dollars are going out to Dubai across the Persian Gulf. A lot of professionals are trying to leave. They're lining up for visas at Western embassies because they so dislike this new president and his hardline rhetoric and his policies. So we have a situation where both the United States and Iran have cards to play and also have vulnerabilities. And, you know, these two countries have been dancing around each other for 27 years now. It will be interesting to see whether there can be some sort of communication, some sort of understanding. The Iranians, you know, were an enormous help to the United States in overthrowing the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. And they have in some ways been helpful in Iraq, although not in all ways.
Well, they were actually happy with the results of that, weren't they?
Very happy. United States got rid of their two worst enemies, right? Taliban regime and Saddam Hussein. We did them an enormous favor.
And is it fair we know that the Iranian opposition was on the ropes in terms of the mullahs, and is there a connection between us blundering next door and undercutting the opposition and being in some way responsible for the resurgence of the reactionaries?
Well, there's a lot of debate about this, and a lot of people, in fairness, I mean, the real blame lies with the Iranian system of government, the way in which unelected people are able to maneuver and go against the wishes of people like Mohammad Khatami, who was elected with very large majorities, much larger than Ahmadinejad's majorities, by the Iranian people. So the system itself is to blame. But a number of reformers in Iran say that when President Bush put the country on the quote-unquote axis of evil in January of 2002, that it was a really big blow because the hardliners in the system turned to the reformers and said, you know, you were trying to improve relations with the U.S. and you see what you've gotten for your pains. So I think that a lot of this heated rhetoric on both sides has been harmful, that the Bush administration sometimes, for domestic political purposes, by pushing so hard on the Iranian regime and exaggerating the very real faults of that system, has actually helped the hardliners there and given them a scapegoat for all of their problems.
And what do you think is the real agenda of the hardliners, particularly in terms of, for example, interfering in the Palestinian-Israeli situation? I mean, I think you can make the case, and others have done this, that the Iranians essentially determined, the Ayatollah Khomeini determined the outcome of the 1980 election by hanging Carter out to dry. And they also perhaps determined the 1996 election in Israel after the assassination of Rabin, when Peres was up against Netanyahu and was the front runner until there were a series of terrorist explosions which played into Netanyahu's hands, and those have been attributed to Iran. So what if this is true, what would their agenda be? What are they trying to lay claim to in terms of frustrating the our attempts at an Arab-Israeli peace?
I think they're determined to, you know, have their regime survive and to extend its influence as far as possible. Given Iran's strategic weakness, at least up until now, when it does not have nuclear weapons, it's sought to exert its influence through proxies, through groups like Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Palestinian territories in Israel, through Hezbollah in Lebanon, through the Shiite militias in Iraq and the Northern Alliance and other groups in Afghanistan. This is the way it is traditionally sought to retaliate against the United States or to, you know, have its cards to play. Iran is not in a position to directly come up against the United States and has not really since the hostage crisis. So I think it's a play for regime survival and influence.
But is it also, is there a Muslim audience here that we're talking about? Is there a sense when the King of Jordan talks about a Shia crescent, are they laying claims as the custodians of Islam?
You know, it's interesting. Ahmadinejad in particular is very interesting. He's not hugely popular in his own country. He's much more popular in a lot of the Arab countries than he is in Iran, which is not an Arab country. His comments, especially about Israel and the Holocaust, play very, very well on the Arab street. And I think he has illusions of grandeur. He's a very, I don't want to be too insulting, but he's not a major figure, or he certainly does not really deserve to be, I think, but he styles himself one. And he is puffing himself up, you know, by appealing to this mass Muslim audience and through his harsh rhetoric against Israel and against the United States. Within Iran, it doesn't play so well because, frankly, most Iranians could care less about the Palestinians. You know, they might sympathize with them as a matter of justice and so on, but they're much more concerned with their own affairs. And there's a lot of hostility and prejudice toward Arabs in Iran, a lot of feelings of superiority over Arabs. After all, Iran is an ancient civilization, you know, more than 2,500 years of recorded history, and Arab civilizations are not so developed and so on. So he is trying to use this issue. As far as the Shia crescent, I know this is a nightmare for a lot of the Sunni regimes. Clearly, Iran has spread its influence into Iraq, into parts of Afghanistan. It has had influence in Lebanon for a very, very long time, has influence in Syria through its support of its regime there. It's an open question how big its influence can be in the Palestinian territories. Hamas and Iran have traditionally not been that close, but now, of course, Hamas may need to seek support from Iran because it's not going to get financial aid from others. It's going to try to get it from Iran. I'm not sure how successful it's going to be.
Well, just in closing, Barbara Slavin, how much is the kind of subversive social revolution that's taking place in Iran against the kind of moralistic oppression of the Ayatollahs and the religious police? Because I understand that the situation has evolved over the years where people are pushing the envelope, women are showing more leg, more of their face. And I just get the feeling that that is ultimately what's going to change the situation, is that people are just simply tired of these strictures. And, eventually the religious police will be a joke.
They already are a joke. You know, the country has already evolved in such a major direction that this is really just propaganda and rhetoric from Ahmadinejad. He can't turn the clock back. He appeals to a very narrow base, maybe 10, 15, maximum 20%, I think, of the population. Most of the rest of the population has moved on. The only thing that can help him, I'm afraid to say, is confrontation with the outside world, especially some kind of military attack, which could cause Iranians to rally around him. But in terms of social issues, it's really a much freer place, frankly, than a lot of Arab countries that I visit, much less religious and much more attuned to the West.
So just in closing, do you foresee any kind of October surprise in Iran? I mean, I can't imagine that the U.S. could get involved in another war, but it doesn't take a lot to get war fever going in terms of perhaps you know, Fox News and others getting caught up in war fever.
Well, I think there is the possibility of airstrikes. That's certainly something that's been talked about quite a lot. My question is what would happen afterwards and whether the administration, which didn't think through what would happen in Iraq after they got rid of Saddam Hussein, whether they've considered what might happen in Iran after such strikes.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Barbara Slavin.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Barbara Slavin, who's been a senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today since 1996. And she's been recently in Iran and has been doing some of the best coverage on Iran. I'm now speaking with General William Odom, who's a senior fellow and director of national security studies at the Hudson Institute's Washington, D.C. office and is an adjunct professor at Yale University. He's also the former head of the National Security Agency and chief of Army Intelligence. And you also had a new recent article comparing Iraq to Vietnam, but of course you've been a consistent and prescient critic of the war in Iraq. And I guess the analogies, the simplest analogies between Iraq and Iran and Vietnam would be strategic blindness.
Yes, I think that's a good way to put it succinctly. Both wars, when we formulated our war aims, were completely unjustified. The interests of the United States were served in neither, and the interests of our enemies were served in both.
Well, it seems that what we have done in Iraq is to move al-Qaeda 1,000 miles closer to Europe.
Well put. I can't disagree with that at all. I said before the war that the two parties that will be most pleased about this war will be al-Qaeda, which will now be able to come into the country and train its cadres there, and number two, Iran, which fought a terrible war with Iraq for 8 years, and no one else would like to see Saddam fall more than the Iranians. So the clerics must have been ecstatic, and Osama bin Laden was joyful.
And what is the possibility, then, I asked our previous guest, who's just been covering, been in Tehran for USA Today, Barbara Slavin, about, this sense that the United States and Iran appear to be playing a kind of game of geopolitical chicken. And I'm wondering whether we will have some kind of a military action, perhaps in the fall.
Well, if we do, we will make the worst strategic disaster in American history, the Iraq War, even worse. One has to understand that we have given the Iranians new sticks to use against us, which they did not have in the past. They are very close to most of the militias in the Shiite part of Iraq. They have provided considerable resources to them. It would be too much to say they really control those militias. They don't.
But they do have the Al-Quds brigades. The Secretary of Defense recently complained that Iran had actually introduced its elite Revolutionary Guards.
Well, the main point is that they have enough influence with the Shiites there so that if they have been telling the Shiites, do not get into an open civil war with the Sunnis. Do what the Americans tell you and you'll end up in power. Now, if we seem to be standing in the way of that, and they decide they want to cause us pain, they can unleash the Bani Sadr type initiatives, Muqtada Sadr's.
Right, the Mahdi Army and the Ba'ath Brigades.
And those are just the ones we know about. I think their capacity to cause us pain is many times greater than the Sunni insurgents. And if we invade them or bomb them something else, they might very well decide to use those capabilities.
Well, there is a sense now that that Iraq is hovering on the cusp of a civil war. There's been this fear all along. And the bombing of the mosque in Samarra, one of its more interesting aspects, I understand, is that the Ahmadinejad, the Iranian leader, is an apocalyptic Shiite who believes in the hidden imam. And that's a kind of messianic version of rather like our Christian fundamentalists who believe in the rapture, and what connects that to the sense that things may be getting out of control was that the mosque that was bombed in Samarra is where the hidden imam apparently disappeared from. It'd be like bombing wherever, you know, the tomb where Jesus was laid to rest, you know. So do you think that, I mean, first of all, who do you think was behind that, and who's trying to provoke a civil war?
I don't think Iran, I don't think Mahdinejad needed to say that to prompt the Sunnis and the Al-Qaeda cadres who are working with the Sunnis there to do that. The Sunnis want a civil war. The Shiites are trying to avoid one. So I don't think it took any. I think there are plenty of people smart enough around Zarqawi and former Ba'athists who are now in the Sunni part of this insurgency to figure out that would be about as provocative a thing as you could do. Now, people are saying, as you just said, that they're on the cusp of civil war. I think they've been in a civil war almost since the first month we were after we invaded Iraq. And a civil war of some kind was inexorably going to happen once we invaded. That was eminently predictable. You just have to decide what you want to call civil war. I mean, I would say Iraqis killing Iraqis is a civil war, and that's been going on since the summer of 2003.
So,
we're just kind of waking up to the Civil War about 3 years after it started.
But General Odom, clearly if it does become a full-blown Civil War rather than this low-intensity, massacre and counter-massacre, there's no way that that could be contained and not slip into a regional war.
Well, maybe, maybe not. I don't think the Iranians want it to become a regional war, and I don't think Turkey and Syria want it to become one.
And certainly Saudi wouldn't.
Certainly not. It's going to be hard on the Iraqis, first of all. Now, what will, I think, occur is that all of these surrounding parties will be playing for influence in the outcome in there. So they will be supplying things. There's no question about that. I doubt that they're going to send their own troops in, if that's what you meant. If you meant that just that they're going to be involved and perhaps supplying or encouraging or playing some sort of diplomatic game within that cauldron, the answer is absolutely true. They are now.
Well, that's the point. It's already, in effect, a surrogate war. The Saudis and the Jordanians and the Gulf are supporting the Sunni, and Iran is supporting the Shia. But the Iranians, again, seem to have much, much more ability to create mischief. For example, the entire populations in the area where the Saudi oil, Bahrain, and all the Gulf are predominantly Shiite, and they're not very happy with the governments there.
You're absolutely right. And again, I think that was foreseeable before all this started, and we're now stuck with it. Do I gather that you're suggesting that we can do something to prevent that?
Well, obviously...
Certainly the way we're going, staying the course, is almost bound to make it happen.
Right. Well, I wonder, frankly, how we weren't paying sufficient attention to allow this train wreck to have happened, because for all of the claims that the administration had in terms of what they were trying to achieve in the Middle East, particularly by going to war against Iraq, they never had a consistent story. But they said that WMD, bring democracy, secure the oil, and to take the pressure off Israel. On every count, they've achieved the opposite. So I can't imagine anybody putting at risk the entire economic lifeline of the Western economies would do so willingly. So, how could we have gotten to this point where it seems to me that things are hanging by a thread? I mean, I understand from people like the former CIA officer in the area, Bob Baer, who wrote about it, it would only take one mortar bomb in a strategically placed to shut down the entire Saudi oil production.
Well, I'm not sure that's the case, but there's not much we can do about it at this stage other than to be aware that something like this can happen. I mean, I'm not prepared to say that these things won't happen. If I had to guess, I'd say the worst scenarios probably will not turn out to be the case if we were to move out fairly quickly. But once we went in, these things were going to happen. And we've just been sitting around in the interim pretending that they would not, or convincing the opponents of the war, trying to convince us we can prevent them by staying in, when in fact we're going to make them worse. You can see that. You can see that from the very beginning. It's going right down that course. And I suspect we will just hang in there until the end and make it as bad as possible. Because the people responsible to the war are not going to take responsibility for failure. But they're not going to do it voluntarily.
Do you think they recognize the extent of this blunder?
I don't think so yet. I don't think so yet.
Well, who are they listening to?
When you get in, I spent 4 years in the White House and a lot of time in the upper echelons of government. And it's a hermetically sealed climate where one can lose touch with reality out there. And when things are going badly, nobody wants to run around and announce gloom and doom. You don't get promoted. You don't sound like a cooperative or productive staff assistant or
team player.
Yeah, you're not a team player. And so there's a great tendency to avoid bringing these issues up and dealing with them. And about the only way you end up dealing with them is your events drive you, and some of those events can be changing public opinion. Remember, that's essentially what did in Vietnam.
I think the reporting in Vietnam was actually much tougher. I think that I don't think that the American public recognize how bad things are in Iraq, and I don't believe that the press has been telling giving us the full picture.
I'm glad you brought that up because I could not agree with you more. Take the piece you just mentioned that I wrote on analogies. No mainstream press will publish that. I've offered it to a few. I finally published it on
Common Dreams and the Nieman Watchdog, right?
Yeah, the Nieman Watchdog. And then it's been cycled. I found, strangely, that perhaps I'm just behind on how this is working in the press, that I can get rather broad and surprisingly broad coverage through web publications. And I just wouldn't have believed that was so. So while the Washington Post, New York Times, and these sorts of publications will ignore it and hope it'll go away, it doesn't. But still, it's not nearly as effective as quickly as it would be if the Times or the Post or some of these others were to publish it.
Do you have any idea why the press is not giving us the full picture? Are they, to some extent, culpable for all of the jingoism in the first place? 3 years ago, you recall, the whole country went nuts thinking this was, how could you have thought for 1 minute that the United States was not going to defeat Iraq? They had already beaten them once, but war fever was gripping everybody.
Well, the press in this issue, the mainstream press, particularly the Washington Post, they were part of the war party. In fact, they're very critical of anybody that wanted to shed doubt on it in those days. Michael Dobbs did a piece which was hidden back in the middle of the Post in February 3rd, 2003, devoted to opponents of the war, people who were making an alternative argument. And he quoted me to some extent in there. He quoted General Zini. He quoted two or three other people here in town, and there was quite an argument going on outside in the public among people like us, but we couldn't get any airtime, none. Well, that's as much as they would give us. And I think the main media in this case, the main media, though, you're causing me to think about this, was pretty pro-war. People tend to forget that the New York Times really didn't turn against the war in Vietnam until the summer of 1968. I was teaching at West Point during those days and would have my students, I'd ask them if they had read lately what our war mission is over there. And the New York Times was the main source of their news at that time, and they didn't like to read the paper, but if you made them read it, they would discover that we were containing China, which was, of course, a major Soviet foreign policy objective at the time. And they would discover that the Post, I mean, the Times was all for it. So there was a, I guess there was more cheering and less critical reporting on the war in the early period. Then when they turned with a vengeance.
Well, that obviously hasn't happened in this case. But so when somebody like your former colleague Zbigniew Brzezinski offers an exit strategy, you know, basically saying, "Look, we should get the Iraqi government to invite the United States to leave, and that the Iraqi government should reach out to its neighbors to get some kind of stability though going, and the United States should withdraw by a date certain within a year." So here's somebody offering up advice to the White House. You're saying the White House aren't listening.
They're not about to. Even his party, the Democrats, won't listen to it. That's what's... And, you know, if you ask... I've asked people that question, and they'll say, well, people will say, look, they voted for the war, now they're scared to death to criticize it.
Well, that's always mystified me, General Odom, is why is it that George W. Bush's mistake has become the Democrats' problem?
Because the Democrats are remarkably stupid and inept. I mean, I'm just staggered at it. Now, who am I to say that it's inept? I don't, the political realities may be something I don't really understand. That's not my, I've never been a political player in that regard. But I'll give you some examples of things that I absolutely astonished me. Remember when Duncan Hunter got upset, or the whole Congress got upset with Hunter, but with Jack Murtha, who said we should get out of Iraq. Rapidly, and there was a big scrap when whether they should take him seriously. And the Democrats sat there, and when the Republicans said, Hunter said, okay, if you guys want to get out of the war, we'll just have a resolution right now that we'll leave tomorrow. How many people are going to vote for it? And what did the Republicans, the Democrats do? They all jumped and said, oh, no. Well, they've been half smart. They would have turned around and said, look, we're all for the war. We want to send 500,000 more troops over there. We want to propose an alternative amendment to raise the troop strength. Well, what would the Republicans have done then? They would have called their bluff. I mean, they don't want to do that. They're scared to death to do that. And the Democrats are not smart enough or not brazen enough to take the Republicans on in the same way. Curiously, some of the most serious critics of the war I've run into the Congress are Republicans. Congressman Walter Jones from North Carolina, Congressman Paul from Houston, Texas. They know this war is wrong. They know they were herded into it. Jones has proposed an amendment to another amendment resolution calling on the Bush to withdraw the troops. It's bottled up. They won't let it go anywhere. He's now trying to get the House, the Speaker of the House, to allow a debate in the House on the war. He said there's never been one. And to sit there and listen to maybe even just a few, a half a dozen Republican congressmen, which I had the privilege to do one day, talk about how they'd been herded and stampeded and sort of whipped into line to do this without any public debate shows you that the Republicans are not of one mind about this at all.
Well, then, just in closing, General Odom, if we are in effect the nation is on autopilot, heading over the cliff. $1 trillion is going to go south. Right. That's the latest estimate. As we mentioned, the net result is that we've emboldened and strengthened both the Shiite fanatics in Tehran and the Sunni fanatics in Al Qaeda. Moved Al Qaeda essentially 1,000 miles closer to Europe, almost up to Israel's border. When and where is the accountability going to come?
I can only say what I have been taught is the American political system. Voters and interest groups have to start pressing their congressmen on this. And if they don't, nothing will happen. They've got that mechanism. Thus far, they haven't been willing to do it. They were willing to do it, it seems to me, more readily in the Vietnam War because we had the draft. Because you have an all-volunteer army, most people can sit home and enjoy their returns on stock gains and pretend that the war doesn't affect them. I know Congressman Jones changed his mind about this whole business when he went down to funerals at Camp Lejeune, the Marine base in his district. And when he listened to people give eulogies and speak at these funerals, he began to get a sense of the reality in Iraq he hadn't had. It really waked him up. I must say, from some of my web reporting or commentary, I've had sentiments out there that I think any shrewd political leader could aggregate. I mean, I get a certain amount of hate mail for it, but I get far overwhelmingly support for most of these things I've said, not hate mail. And many of these people say, nobody's speaking for me. Well, you're out there in California. Where are your two senators? Where is your large congressional delegation? I sit there and listen to Gene Harmon in the Intelligence Reform Bill letting the Republicans blame George Tenet for the war. Who hires and fires George Tenet? The president. She should have turned her guns on the president. Not on the intelligence community. Now, the intelligence community has its problems, and I'm not defending George Tenet on this. But the place where the blame was should have been placed was at the president's feet. They wouldn't touch him. Wouldn't touch him. Democrats. And then you let's look. There's an issue here where you have to bring it in. You found the Likud government in Israel and AIPAC in this country were very strong for the war, and they have really put a lot of their pressure on people to support it. And I think that may explain to some degree the weakness of the Democrats. What's curious about that is, if you pay any attention to the debate in Israel, you won't find a unified view on that. And what's the real consequences of the war are going to lead to a much more serious and dangerous strategic situation for Israel. Sunni, or the Shiite, advisors from Iran will come in and train up Iraqi Shiite terrorists who will stream across Jordan into the West Bank and Lebanon. That's going to happen in big time. And why anybody who gives a damn about the security of Israel could be for this, I don't know. But if you look at who was for the war, it was certainly people who thought they were speaking the neocons were for Israel's strategic interest. And I just don't think they understand Israel's strategic interest.
Well, I think it's hard to understand because that whole genesis, and I believe there's an interesting book out, the General Trainer and New York Times reporter has written, it sort of catalogs this catastrophe. But it does seem strange to me why Rumsfeld and Cheney have, because after all, they're the ones who empowered the neocons. The neocons were just this sort of nutty group that had been around Washington for a long time.
Well, these are neocons with a lot of influence. That Cheney and Rumsfeld would have had great difficulty ignoring.
Right, but they not so much they ignored them. They bought their whole thing, hook, line, and sinker. Did
well,
they not?
I quite agree, and that was there's no question about that. The point I'm making is that you asked me why some of these things happen. Mm. I have great difficulty imagining us invading Iraq if you had not had this lobby effort.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, General Odom, and for your efforts to bring your experience to light in the context of this manifest disaster. And it is extraordinary that I just, for the life of me, I do not understand why here we have something like 60% plus percent of the American people who in polls after polls say that they want us out. They think it's a mistake. They seem to get it. That's what Jack Murtha says. The American people are way ahead of the government.
Oh, they are.
So why the government and the press in this country are so wedded to this catastrophe, it's mystifying.
It is, indeed. I can't help you more there than I already have. But again, we do have mechanisms to do something about this, and that is to speak our minds to our representatives in the Congress. Now, I must say, I think it will be much more effective if the opposition to the war is led by people like more conservative elements in the government, in the Congress.
You mean the Walter Joneses of the world, yeah?
Yeah, because you see, what that'll do is prevent this thing from becoming radicalized to the left. What happened in the Vietnam War?
Right.
They were spitting on soldiers as they came home. And the soldiers didn't start the war.
Right.
And, you know,
the best and brightest did, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the people really out. There were a lot of people in the anti-war movement in that period who did not have the U.S. interest at heart at all. They had hurting our interest at heart. And I lived through that. I witnessed that up close. Well, and I can tell you right now that I hope we're smart enough this time not to let the loony left take charge of this resistance.
Well, on that note, I thank you very much for joining us, General William Odom.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. So just speaking then with General William Odom, who's a former head of the National Security Agency and chief of Army Intelligence. And I'm now speaking with Todd Gitlin, who's a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University and the author of The Intellectuals and the Flag. And Todd, obviously, the sale of Knight Ritter indicates that Wall Street is now more and more determining what Americans get in terms of their information and news.
Well, since American newspapers became corporations for sale in the marketplace, they sent themselves careening down this path. When Tony Ritter became head of the Knight Ritter chain in the mid-90s, he said that it was his goal to take a company that was making about 8% profit and move it to 15%. Well, in recent years, they've been making over 20, and that still wasn't enough to satisfy Wall Street, because Wall Street looks at a newspaper firm and doesn't measure it against what other newspaper firms are making or other companies of that sort. They measure it against what a company is making on broadcasting or on broadband or some other technology, and they're going to find it wanting. They don't care about newspapers as such, and so the newspaper business has been in a long-running panic, and this is the outcome. McClatchy has done what it's done. If Gannett or another company had bought it, it would have been worse. And I just came from a conference a few days ago with newspaper people who were all, I would say, in a state of either slow or rapid motion panic.
And the McClatchy who bought the Knight Ritter chain, they also apparently going to divest the many of the jewels, like the Miami Herald, Philadelphia, and San Jose Mercury News, to the second bidder, I understand, who is an extremely bottom-line oriented operation.
Well, they're all bottom-line operations. they're acting like a company who's just bought a chain of hotels or steel mills. I mean, you know, why should newspapers be any different from their point of view? These are not people who have the best interests of newspapers or political democracy in mind. They're simply interested in profitability, period.
So, Todd Gitlin, I guess we're all naive in thinking that somehow there is some public trust here in the media, that there's some mechanism or tradition or something that requires the owners of the media to inform the public. And the truth of the matter is that there is no such thing, that we have always been at the whim of the moguls who own the media and subject to their personal predilections. And we only got lucky that CBS's head of CBS television was a visionary, Bill Paley, and didn't mind losing money because he wanted to beat out the New York Times and set a high standard. Turner was a fairly benevolent billionaire in terms of his outlooks on in wanting to inform the public. On the other side, you've got a more malevolent strain with the Murdochs of this world who just want us to be Republican consumers essentially have created a kind of version of Pravda for the Republican Party. So, in Europe, for example, and in England, the BBC sets a standard. Are we sort of whistling into the wind here, expecting or hoping that there's some kind of standard set?
Yes. The wind is whistling back, and what it's whistling is Dixie. What it's whistling is cram the bucks down the pockets, and the public interest is absolutely immaterial for them. I think it would be innocent to the point of stupidity to expect otherwise. The families who own the New York Times and the Washington Post and a couple other companies set up a system of multiple stock ownership in which the family retains control. And while this doesn't lead to the splendors of perfection itself, it at least makes possible the insulating of the newspaper from the immediate pressures of quarterly returns. But Knight Ridder papers were making over 20%. That wasn't good enough. There's no way to satisfy the sort of buccaneers like Bruce Sherman, whose hedge fund owned the largest block of shares in Knight Ridder. They could care less about newspapers. There's absolutely no way to deflect them. It would be foolish to expect them to act differently.
And the family-owned papers that you mentioned that sort of hold on to some kind of standard and independence, they are, at least in the case of the Chandlers, they're long gone here in California.
Yeah.
And the Tribune Company out of Chicago took that over. And, of course, whenever these papers are taken over, the people who buy them out incur a lot of debt. And the way that they offset that debt is by firing a lot of people, cutting costs, and by cutting costs, of course, they reduce the coverage, and particularly in bureaus abroad. So that seems to be the pattern.
Right. They're cutting muscle. I was talking to somebody the other day from the Baltimore Sun. He was telling me they had five bureaus, but two of them are foreign overseas bureaus. But two of them are in the process of being closed, and he didn't think the other three were long for this world, and that's how it goes. The muscle is the stuff to cut first, and people are migrating away from the dead tree edition of the newspaper. They're going online. They have lots of other choices. They're going to headlines circulated by Yahoo and other portals. They're the generation, as the big newspaper readers who are old people die off, they're not going to be replaced by other newspaper readers. They're being replaced by podcasters. Listeners, and the newspapers are scrambling, trying to figure out what to do. That I just heard a chorus of them saying, "Where is the next business model to take us through this veil of tears?" They don't have it.
But just if there's no social obligation, there's no. In fact, and the shareholder obligation is just to make profit and more of it. There's no sense of public trust. So inevitably, the mainstream media will get more and more into infotainment and away from news. It's just inevitable, isn't it?
In a word, yes.
So the only good news in your mind is the fact that people are finding alternatives via the internet, but of course that, you know, to me, I don't know how you sort the wheat from the chaff in that world.
Well, I don't think that that is splendid news all by itself. If you look at the list of the major internet sources of so-called news, it's most of it is infotainment. It's sports, porn, and infotainment. So no, there's no in this current setting, there is no good news. Period.
So I guess
I know that's un-American, but there is.
So that, to some extent, you know, General Odom was on before you, trying to he was literally puzzling on the air as to why it is that this incredibly unpopular war is still effectively being supported by this blind, out of touch government we have, who are digging the hole deeper, and a complicitous press. And he was trying to figure it out why. And is it in any way connected to what we're talking about? Is it they are just only interested in I mean, what could their interest be in not serving the public and telling the truth?
Well, the press on the war on Iraq has been playing catch up after an ignominious beginning, and I think if you were paying attention to the news, you would find plenty of reasons to conclude rationally that the war had been a misguided enterprise, and the debate now ought to be about the means to extricate rather than the means to stay. Here I think that the press is inhibited not so much by its market-mindedness as by its pattern of deference, their unwillingness to draw the lines, to connect the dots, to make it clear that this has been an administration from the beginning that was drunk on its belligerence and its eagerness to prove itself right despite everything, and no change on that score. Meantime, I don't get the sense that vast numbers of Americans are paying close attention. There's a kind of sodden acceptance of the rights of the government to do as it will. And this is
I guess we don't have a parliamentary system here where
we certainly don't.
Bush would be out with
confidence. Yes,
yeah, he'd have lost a no confidence vote. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome,
Los Angeles, Todd Gitlin. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking here with Todd Gitlin, a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University, the author of The Intellectuals and the Flags. And I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Jay Shepard, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer. This program and all previous ones are available at ianmasters.org.